Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays, Fridays, and occasionally subbing for me. And today I'm talking about the scientific or unscientific status of different hypotheses about what happened at the World Trade Center, including those of Stephen Jones. And I'm very pleased to have on as my special guest for the first hour, and I want to keep her on for the first segment of our second hour, Judy Wood, whom I consider to be the most highly qualified individual who belongs to Scholars for 9/11 Truth. She has degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, materials, engineering science. Now, I just want to emphasize, I mean, Steve Jones has a degree in physics, and he's done work on cold fusion and archaeometry, some of which I have been discussing. But Judy has far more specific background of appropriate relevance to the World Trade Center and its phenomena in terms of her civil engineering, engineering mechanics, and materials engineering science background. So it is my judgment of all of those I have ever dealt with, and it's been quite a large number now, you know, hundreds of members of scholars, for example, and many others. She appears to me to be the single most qualified individual to ever study this case. Judy, welcome on to the Dynamic Duo.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I wanted to read a paragraph that I discovered on this website for Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, and ask for your reaction to it. And anyone who wants to go there, as I said, it's like st911.org, but with a J. So it's stj911.org. And you will not have trouble finding it, because this website's in a very preliminary stage. There's not a lot there. But what is there includes this. Various attacks on Stephen Jones. I'm quoting. Stephen E. Jones, a 20-year professor of physics, brought unprecedented credibility to the challenges to the official explanation of the destruction of the World Trade Center skyscrapers when he published Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Completely Collapse in late 2004. Predictably, Jones was targeted with a campaign of attacks characterized by misrepresentations of his work and ad hominems, primarily from individuals and persons embracing unscientific alternative theories of the attack. Shortly before the fifth anniversary of the attack, Morgan Reynolds and Judy Wood teamed up to author the first of several attack pieces against Jones. And then there are two pieces cited. One is Reply to Reynolds and Wood by Stephen E. Jones, and another a Response to Reynolds and Wood by Frank Leahy. Now, Judy, I'm very interested in talking with you about this, but that's something that struck me immediately is that they don't cite your paper. I mean, if they're going to say that you do all this, it seems to me that fair is fair. You ought to cite where people can go and read the original and make their own judgments about what you and Morgan have or have not said.
Right. It seems very clear to me that they don't want people to make their own judgment.
Something that bothers me tremendously is this word predictably. They say predictably he was targeted with a campaign of attacks characterized by misrepresentations of his work in ad hominems. Now, you know, this business about ad hominems can be very subtle, which I was seeking to illustrate by this initial discussion about his work on claiming to have archaeological evidence for the visitation of Christ after his resurrection to North America. Now, this is a very subtle business. Is there anything ad hominem about it? I would argue not, because he's claiming to have scientific evidence for this, and it appears that the kind of evidence he's citing is a perfect example of the ink blot phenomena that occurred in the case of Eric von Doniger's Chariots of the Gods that Kenneth Vedder talks about in his book Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries. So, you know, based upon all my research and past, doing without having delved into detail into Steve Jones' work, which I look forward to doing when I can track down a copy, it appears to me to be a pretty good case that falls into the category of this ink blot phenomenon, and therefore to be highly subjective and not reliable, and in the category of pseudoscience. Now, here, when they say predictably, they're implying that those who are criticizing Jones don't have any good reason for doing so, and that it's a political smear, and that it's all ad hominem. That's what they're doing. They're begging the question, in other words, by the use of that word predictably. And, of course, they're saying it mischaracterizes his work. How can we know whether you have or have not mischaracterized his work if we don't know what you have said about it? And in addition, of course, then presumably had access to his work, which is not hard to do because I have all this up on Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
And he does not want to come on your show today to defend his position, which I find interesting.
Yeah, it fascinates me, the many opportunities I've given Stephen Jones now to come on, you know, in various fora and present his views and defend them. That's very troublesome to me.
What is most interesting is there's nothing much of substance on that site except for this page labeled disinformation. And it's a little bit humorous that on this page where he's pointing out disinformation, he presents disinformation.
Well, that would be highly ironic indeed.
He states, as you read, why indeed the World Trade Center building completely collapsed in late 2004. I don't believe he even was questioning the events of 9/11
in 2004.
Right.
So this is
disinformation.
Shouldn't that be 2005? I know by 2005 he was questioning it.
In late 2005, he came out with his first paper. It wasn't even entitled that. It was Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse? Now he's changed the title of name recently. But it was not in 2004 that his paper came out.
You mean he's added this word completely?
Yeah, that word completely came about in the past few months.
You know, something that's fascinated me, Judy, is that in an exchange with Jeff Stahl, Strahl, a recent exchange, I mean, so recent that on the 27th of December, Steve Jones was responding to Jeff, who was raising questions about what evidence that Steve Jones had that thermite could be used to bring down a building. And Steve cites a patent for a device that can cut steel, but the patent is for a device that can cut 2 inches of steel, and of course, as most students of the case know, the steel at the World Trade Center began at the base. It was 400 millimeters or 4 inches thick, and then it tapers off to the top where it becomes as thin as 6 millimeters or a quarter of an inch thick. But you'd have to have, for the thermite to do it, presumably you'd have to cut through a whole lot more than just 2 inches of steel. So here is a response. I'm quoting now an email from Steve responding to Jeff. He says, Jeff, the patent points out that the devices can be placed on either side of the steel. That's cutting up to about 4 inches. This with thermite using copper oxide per the patent, but not sulfur. Sulfur will enhance the cutting effect. And then he says, one cannot rule out the use of thermite or super thermite cutters for the WTC just because it has not been used before for demolition. Now, to me, that was fairly astonishing, Judy, because I would have presumed that Steve had a strong case for the past use of these types of causes, thermite, to perform demolition, and from what I infer here, he has no evidence that, in fact, it's ever been used for that purpose before.
Correct. And Morgan Reynolds and I wrote a paper posing these various issues to Stephen Jones, which he has not responded to. One of which, where in history ever has thermite ever been used to bring down a skyscraper and control demolition?
Now, my impression is this falls into the category of the area known as proof of concept, where you're offering a demonstration that something like your claim is a real possibility. A real possibility. We'll return to this issue of proof of concept during my conversation with Judy Wood in just one moment. This is the Dynamic Duo with your host, Jim Fetzer. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays and occasionally subbing for me. Today I have my special guest the first hour and into the second, Judy Wood, who in my opinion is the most highly qualified individual to ever study the events of 9/11. We're talking about certain claims that are made on a new Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice website in defense of the scientific character of Steve Jones' research and the unscientific character of the alternatives that have been proposed by, among others, Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds. And Judy, the paper you and Morgan wrote, as I understand, is the one right here found on st911.org. If you go to Founders Corner, the scientific method applied to the thermite hypothesis, 14 December. Is that right?
No, someone seemed to have taken down the site today. The site got hacked or something happened.
Well, actually, I'm on it right now, and it's working right now.
Oh, it did come back up. Oh, great.
Yeah, I'm happy to say. Right, and I found your other articles were working, too. I tried to call you to mention that, but they seemed to be back up.
Okay.
But the point I'm making is this is the right article, is it not?
It's thermite and the scientific method.
Right, the scientific method applied to the thermite hypothesis,
yes.
Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds, December 14th, 2006.
And if someone wants to access this, if you go to 911scholars.org, and the upper left-hand corner, you'll see a link to click on, and you'll see the list of the files we temporarily put
Judy,
there.
Judy, it's all right here. It's already on st911.org.
Okay.
Now,
great.
Let me just mention for anyone out there that by special arrangement with Ted Anderson, if you'd like to have a copy of this article, you can call 1-800-360-8695. 1-800-360-8695. Tell him you'd like the article, The Scientific Method Applied to the Thermite Hypothesis by Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds, which is found in the Founders Corner box on st911.org. And Genesis Communications Network will send it to you with their compliments. So I just want to say this is a wonderful thing that Ted Anderson is doing. Articles of mine that appear on my public issues website, assassinationscience.com, my JFK research website, assassinationresearch.com, or on st911.org can be yours by special request, special arrangement. Just call 1-800-360-8695, and Genesis will be glad to send them to you. Now, Judy, when I look at your scientific method paper applied to the Thermite Hypothesis, the first thing that struck me is Steve Jones' own conception of scientific method, which you have a slide from his talks, and I've seen it many times, and it talks about what is the scientific method, and it lists certain steps or stages. Gather observations, evidence, that's the first. Make hypothesis to explain, that's the second. Third, experiments to test hypothesis to acquire more data. Refine or reject hypothesis, more experiments.
It never goes back to see if it matches the observations.
Well, hang on. Publish in peer review venues, repeat above cycle, generate theory model of reality. Now, my field as a philosopher of science includes dealing with different models of scientific method. And I've been troubled by this because it's not a defensible conception of the nature of science. And now, this is an observation I'm making, Judy, based upon my own professional background and expertise. You can't begin with observations because you don't know what observations to make. I'm reminded of the case of the eccentric millionaire who'd spent his whole life writing down every sound, every observation he'd make. If a butterfly flew by the window, he'd jot it down. If he heard a siren in the background, he'd jot it down. And when his attorney sought to bestow this precious legacy on the Smithsonian Institute, they turned it down. And, of course, the reason is that observations, willy-nilly, unguided by an hypothesis, may have no scientific significance whatsoever, which means that the hypothesis has to come before the observations. And when he says, make hypothesis to explain, and this is what troubles me the most, he's talking about a single hypothesis, a correct characterization of scientific method. And, you know, I can't begin to explain how much time I have put into demonstrating, proving that this is the most adequate conception. We begin with puzzlement. Yeah, it sounds like observation, except that observation can be willy-nilly. Puzzlement means you encounter some phenomenon, you don't know how to explain it, it doesn't fit into your background knowledge. So it sets up a problem to be solved. This is the case with the World Trade Center. You got the two buildings coming down, the rapidity with which they disappear, according to the 9/11 Commission report, 10 seconds for the South Tower. The NIST uses the figures 9 and 11 seconds. We can talk about that because you've done this beautiful study that demonstrates conclusively that if these buildings are coming down under, solely under the influence of gravity, they can't possibly have come down that fast, which I consider to be one of the most elegant proofs that the government's account can't possibly be correct that anyone has ever produced. But you have puzzlement. Then speculation. Speculation is the crucial stage. It involves considering all the possible alternative possible explanations. And the reason why you have to consider the full range is that so much of science proceeds by a method of eliminating alternative possibilities until you're left with the one that appears to be the most defensible. It's that Sherlock Holmesian notion that when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains however improbable must be the truth. But if you don't begin with a full range of alternative possible explanations, which in this case might include thermite, other modes of conventional destruction, mini-nukes, directed energy weapons, HARP weapons, whatever, you need the full range in order for scientific inquiry to get off the ground. And then, of course, you proceed by adapting the hypothesis to the evidence. Roughly, it's a matter of calculating the likelihood of each different hypothesis in relation to the totality of the evidence, which in this case includes the massive devastation to the World Trade Center, includes the non-functional disruption of the bathtub, includes the toasted cards and all this other fascinating evidence to which you and Morgan have drawn such striking attention. where you ask, if this hypothesis were true, if thermite-thermate were the true hypothesis, or if mini-nukes were the true hypothesis, or if directed energy were the true hypothesis, or if HARP were the true hypothesis, what's the probability if those hypotheses were true of getting this evidence? And that determines the likelihood or the degree of evidential support the evidence provides the hypothesis. I have reached the point, Judy, of being convinced that when you look at the totality of the evidence, the thermite-thermate hypothesis confers a probability on that totality evidence that approximates zero, that at best it can provide a partial explanation for collapse of some floors, but that this is a much too complex phenomenon, and that thermite-thermate just can't cut it. Now, when you compare the likelihoods of the alternative hypotheses, then the hypothesis with the highest likelihood is the preferable hypothesis, and when there's sufficient evidence available, when the evidence is settled down, in other words, and all more or less points in the same direction, then you're entitled to accept the preferable hypothesis. Now, I just wonder, Judy, whether you would be inclined to agree that from your point of view as an expert in material structure science, for example, that the thermite-thermate hypothesis has approximately a zero probability of explaining the available evidence.
Correct, because it's sort of mutually exclusive with the observed data. But in terms of the scientific method, my interpretation of that in simple terms is first establishing what happened. Before you think of how it happened, just look at what happened and see if you can determine that and model it put it in some sort of an outline form, what happened. Then, once you've done that, look at how it happened, then why it happened. But if you start with why and then go backwards, you're not going to get to the right answer. You start out with the political method, as Stephen Jones often refers to, you end up with getting the description that you dial in and want. But if we look at what happened, thermite cannot explain the pulverization that we saw.
This is a very important point, Judy, and I want you to elaborate on it. My understanding is that Jones' hypothesis, that is thermite-thermate in combination, that not only cut the steel but pulverized the concrete flooring material, the office furniture, the desks, the computers, living things, including human beings, into very fine particles, that those are virtually mutually exclusive causal mechanisms, so that because cutting requires a focused energy and pulverization requires a diversified energy.
Correct.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Judy Wood. I'm going to invite her to discuss what she sees as the principal problems with the thermite-thermate hypothesis right after this break. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays, Fridays, and occasionally subbing for me with my special guest for the first hour. I'm carrying her over into the second hour, Judy Wood, who has a background in mechanical, civil engineering mechanics, and materials structure science, and is the single best qualified person in the research community studying the events of 9/11, in my judgment. Judy, you and I and Morgan have been the subjects of an enormous volume of attack based upon mere speculation, rumor, and false impression, most importantly because the claim is made that you and I and Morgan are specifically endorsing one or another hypothesis about how all of this massive destruction was brought about, when in fact that's completely untrue. I have gone through your website repeatedly, looked at the photographs, studied the evidence you presented. I've been overwhelmingly impressed with the extensiveness of the destruction, with the fact that you have 500,000-ton buildings that are coming down, and yet the bathtub remains undamaged to the extent that it's not functional, that if it had been damaged to cease being functional, that water from the Hudson River would have flooded the PATH train tunnels under the Hudson, they would have flooded the subways, caused massive destruction, undermined the foundations of enormous buildings, would have run hundreds of billions of dollars and probably taken a decade to clean the mess up, and then all the toasted cars, and yet you only talk about possibilities. All you and Morgan have ever addressed are possibilities.
First of all, I'd like to note that our paper is not finished yet. As we explained, it's under construction. We felt that the need to work on this in full public view for safety purposes. But the first five pages of our paper are only data. We're presenting data. We're presenting the evidence that must be explained.
Right, and what's unscientific about that? In fact, it seems to me to be simply absurd for you to be criticized for being unscientific when you're giving a more full and adequate definition or elaboration of what's technically known as the explanandum, what it is that has to be explained, than anyone has ever done before. Certainly, it's not the sort of thing that I have seen Steve Jones or his supporters ever do. So for them to fault you for merely elaborating on the explanandum, what it is we have to explain, seems to me to be completely unjust. And then to hold you accountable for one specific causal mechanism when all you've done is to suggest there are a multiplicity of possibilities, and I have heard you repeatedly not commit yourself to one or another when I have interviewed you about these subjects before.
Correct. There's a lot of possibilities out there. What we've done is eliminate various things, like gravity collapse, for example.
Yes.
It contradicts a whole lot of the data. We're not just hinging everything on one particular data point. It's a cumulative evidence. It's a cumulative case.
And what I find so bizarre about the other side's criticism is, so far as I can tell, actually, the thermite hypothesis, when it's used for both the effect of cutting steel and pulverization, is actually an incoherent theory, meaning it contradicts itself because we're talking about two incompatible types of causal mechanism.
Correct. They're mutually exclusive. If you're going to drop a building with a gravity collapse, yeah, you might have angle cut columns, but that doesn't. Then how do you get pulverized building that did not hit the ground? It doesn't add up. But another technique that I've seen used is they do not want folks to look at the data.
Well, let me just emphasize, draw on this one point, Judy. For any scientific theory or hypothesis to be true, it has to, at the very least, be consistent. It must be possible for it to be true. If you're positing a causal mechanism that is, in fact, incoherent because it requires inconsistent properties, incompatible properties, then you don't even have that minimal condition satisfied of having a consistent theory. And that is the minimal condition on a scientific hypothesis.
It's like saying that this car accident happened by this car moving forward too fast, and then the next sentence saying it was because it was moving backwards and backing up. It's just like you got to pick one or the other.
So I really wonder, you know, the extent to which those who are criticizing you for being, and Morgan, for being unscientific, and defending Steve for being scientific, have actually thought this through. If he has an incoherent hypothesis, how can they possibly defend it? It can't possibly be true from scratch.
I think it's that there's nothing that anyone can understand about it, and no one can question it.
Something I like about your study is you begin with proof of concept, which is some kind of demonstration, illustration, or exhibit that the kind of causal mechanism, in this case you have in mind, thermite, can do what, say, Steve would have it do at the World Trade Center, in particular in 1 and 2. Now, I think, Judy, that the response of his supporters would be that he's demonstrated his proof of concept by putting a thermite bomb or canister on top of an engine block and watching it burn all the way through.
But that's not a building getting pulverized.
That's not only not a building getting pulverized, but as I thought back over it over and over, you know, the amount of time it takes to do that has to be at least 10 or more seconds. I mean, more time is required for it to perform this particular specific task than was involved in the complete demolition of 210-story buildings.
Correct.
So who's being unscientific? I mean, it's very strange to me that persons who present themselves as being serious or present themselves as being scientists would present, you know, a theory that isn't even logically consistent because it involves incompatible causal mechanisms and would offer a proof of concept that actually tends to demonstrate that it can't possibly have been the cause because it required as much time just to illustrate that proof of concept as the entire destruction of 110-story buildings.
Yeah, I also have concerns about if you're going to have a specifically timed sequence of cutting with thermite, how do you control that timing? Because it's kind of random, as it appears, as to how that proof of concept was demonstrated with the engine block.
Did you find that a curious demonstration at the time, or did you find it, fairly reasonable?
I didn't see the relationship between the engine block demonstration and what that has to do with bringing down a skyscraper.
Now, the engine block, see, this is, Was it some kind of thermite grenade he was using? Because, you know, the engine block is more massive than 4 inches thick of steel. So it must be something different than the thermite or thermite device that has been patented for the destruction of buildings, where you'd have to put two of them on either side if you wanted to destroy a 4-inch column.
Well, I myself, not being in the controlled demolition business, consulted an expert that I know who works controlled demolition. And when I brought up the word thermite to them, they said, what? Thermite? They didn't even know if that word existed. You'd heard of thermite and some grenades that get used in the military to destroy your opponent's artillery.
Right.
But they didn't know of anything like that to use for controlled demolition.
Right. If you go onto Wikipedia, for example, and look at thermite, you find that it's a very convenient device for destroying artillery weapons. You drop it down the barrel, and it's so hot that it melts the mechanism, the firing mechanism and loading mechanisms in an artillery piece, and renders it completely useless.
Or the joints of a cannon, so it fuses it at the joint.
Or the joints of a cannon, which can be fused. So it seems to me that there's something very peculiar about this research program. Because it doesn't seem to me that it was based upon a sufficient search of the literature to determine whether or not it was even a remotely plausible mechanism. I think so many members of the research community wanted to have some hard science proof, and this is a man who even calls himself Hard Evidence as his email handle. So many wanted some hard science evidence that they were willing to grasp at straws and take whatever came along, and here came Stephen Jones with his offer of thermite.
If you go to the bottom of our Appendix 1 page, there's several... Well, it's also on this scientific methods paper. There's some Google searches to search for controlled demolition and thermite, and you only come up with stuff related to Stephen Jones.
Judy, why don't you stand by and for the next segment? We'll see if Morgan's available, and I'll keep you on for a while and then bring Morgan in. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder Mondays and Fridays and occasionally subbing for me with my special guest, Judy Wood, maybe the most qualified individual to ever study the events of 9/11. And I'm going to be bringing in Morgan Reynolds, too, if we have him on the line here momentarily. Judy, I'd like to say, as a philosopher of science, it has seemed to me that Stephen Jones' research satisfies the conception of what's known as a degenerating research program defined by Imre Lakatos, L-A-K-A-T-O-S, in a brilliant essay he wrote in a collection he co-edited entitled Criticism and the Growth of Knowledge, where Lakatos talks about a research program that simply isn't panning out. It's not spawning new research, it's not producing new papers, it's not inspiring new experiments, and it seems to me but that's pretty much where Stephen Jones has gone. I mean, that his research program is more or less petering out. I mean, about mid-year here, about in June, about the time of the American Scholars Conference, that I just sensed that the potential for his approach to pan out was not very great. And I thought it became increasingly important to separate our refutations of the government's account, where we have massive evidence that the government's account is false, which you can find, for example, summarized in Why Doubt 9/11 on st911.org. Just go up to the top of the menu bar, go down the beginner's side, and you'll find it right away, where I've enumerated 15 major reasons why the government's account is indefensible, how we know it's false, how we can prove it's false, and not even physically possible.
Actually, Jim, I'd like to differ with you slightly. This is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there's some seriousness here. That just by watching what's Stephen Jones focuses on or focuses away from is a very good clue as to what to look at or what not to look at. Note the opposite. He desperately does not want you to look at the article that Morgan and I are working on. Ah, perhaps because we are correct. Perhaps it's validation. Why are we always accused of being these rabid no-planers? First of all, I've never stated one way or the other where I stand on if planes did or didn't hit the towers. So why is that statement being made over and over again? It's to keep you from thinking about whether or not planes hit, keep you from evaluating it, and just keep on, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid and going with keep believing the pledge because the government said so. Don't question the government. Don't question the government story. Just keep believing it.
Well, Judy, I think you're making excellent points. Now, what I was driving at is this. Refuting the government's account is one thing, and we have done that overwhelmingly. Explaining what actually happened is another far more difficult task, and I'm afraid that many of those out there who, you know, aren't doing research themselves may have a rather feeble grasp of science, have sort of latched on to Stephen Jones' attempt to explain what actually happened, because in their minds, if Jones' thermite is true, then it must be the case that the government's account is false, and they don't have to worry about things like melting points and temperatures and speeds of disintegration and all that. And yet these are completely separate matters from a logical point of view. Refuting the government's position has been done in spades. Explaining exactly what happened, that's far more challenging, far more difficult. That's where Steve Jones comes in, and it's almost irresistible. I think those who are relatively unsophisticated intellectually about the nature of science, they want to glom onto it. They want to hang on to it. That thermite is something they feel they can hold in their hands as though it's real. And they don't seem to appreciate at all the context within which this whole approach has emerged, with what appears to be a lack of a literature search, no proof of concept, and in the context of what appears to me to be a degenerating research program.
And I wonder if folks realize that, while we're busy looking, I don't know, do you know what a straw man is?
Of course.
It's
an exaggerated version of a position which you can more readily attack and then claim to have dispatched the readily available, more defensible version.
I wonder if the listeners realize that thermite and thermite have already been attacked and disproven, and that was the only case for controlled demolition that was considered.
By NIST.
Yes.
I think that's very important, Judy, that you have discovered that NIST has already considered the hypothesis that Steve Jones continues to defend, that thermite may have been the responsible agent here.
And has already debunked it.
This is very troubling. Because to the best of my knowledge, Steve Jones has never acknowledged that, and yet it's part of all of the available evidence. Remember, a basic principle of scientific research is called the requirement of total evidence, which dictates that you must base your reasoning on all of the available relevant evidence, which is why it's so terribly, terribly important to consider the totality of the devastation of the World Trade Center. Now, I have sometimes put it this way, Judy. Even if Steve Jones' explanation were good as gold regarding World Trade Center 1 and 2, the North and South Tower, that would not explain what happened to WTC 3, WTC 4, WTC 5, or WTC 6, even if we set 7 aside as a special case involving classic controlled demolition.
Correct.
And that point you so beautifully
good
made
cars.
That this destruction is almost surgical. It's as though all and only the buildings with a WTC prefix were destined to be demolished.
Not even the buildings across the street.
Not even the buildings across the street.
How do you take down two buildings that are over a quarter mile tall with very little spilling over across the street? It was an amazing job that was done.
I think that anyone who's serious about this has got to go to your website. Can you give us the Judy, I'll just tell everyone, if they go on to st911.org and scroll down into articles, they'll find a whole section of Judy Woods and Morgan Reynolds' website where you can find it, and it's identified with the heading, I'm looking for it right here.
Star Wars beam weapon?
Hypothesis. Star Wars beam weapon hypothesis. What you want to do is go there. The Star Wars beam weapon hypothesis, go there, Jane Doe, 0911.tripod.com, and you'll see all these studies, which are absolutely fascinating. When I first went on the air, talking with Judy about this on the, like, let's see, was it the 11th of November, I was so excited and so enthusiastic that a lot of people misunderstood and misconstrued as though I were immediately endorsing the idea that some Star Wars weaponry had been employed here, when what I was endorsing was broadening the range of alternative hypotheses for consideration and especially emphasizing the totality of the devastation to the World Trade Center as an entity, the non-demolition of the bathtub and the destruction of the toasted cars. Judy, do you see any possible way that a thermite hypothesis could begin to explain these phenomena?
Those toasted cars are like half mile to a mile away. Yeah, how can you get cars with their tires melting into the pavement do that half mile to a mile away instantly?
So it's pretty stunning stuff. And I think that, you know, if we can't all get a grip on the explanandum in its full dimensions, the totality of the devastation, how thorough it was.
And no, we are not concluding as to exactly what did it.
Right. This is just getting clear on what it is we have to explain.
Yeah.
We're not making any presumption.
A BB gun couldn't do it. A slingshot couldn't do it.
You know, it's going to have to be something that has the potential to bring about that degree of devastation. Now, after this break, we'll either be back with Judy Wood, or if Morgan Reynolds is available, I'll bring him in. And Judy, if I don't have the chance to thank you then, I want to thank you now for being my special guest. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, where you can hear Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays and occasionally subbing for me. It's a great pleasure to welcome now my second guest during this program, Morgan Reynolds. He was the chief economist in the Department of Labor under the George W. Bush from 2001 to 2002, former director of the Criminal Justice Center, the National Center for Policy Analysis, professor emeritus, Texas A&M University, and in my opinion, one of the most brilliant men I've ever dealt with. Morgan, it's a great pleasure to have you on the air.
Happy New Year, Jim.
Happy New Year to you, my friend. Listen, I've gone to this new website created by this group, this faction that has broken away from Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and I find there's very little there, but what there is merits consideration, because they've got a paragraph, for example, a couple that would be of interest to you, but let me read this one. Various attacks on Stephen Jones. Stephen E. Jones, a 20-year professor of physics, brought unprecedented credibility to the challenges to the official explanation of the destruction of the World Trade Center skyscrapers when he published Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Completely Collapse in late 2004. We've already determined, incidentally, Morgan, that has to be a year off. It had to be 2005. Predictably, Jones was targeted with a campaign of attacks characterized by misrepresentations of his work and ad hominems, primarily from individuals and persons embracing unscientific alternative theories of the attack. Shortly before the fifth anniversary of the attack, Morgan Reynolds and Judy Wood teamed up to author the first of several attack pieces against Jones. How would you respond to that, Morgan?
Three parts. First of all, yes, I would claim his brag about credibility was true initially. Even Judy was enthusiastic about Steve's appearance in the 9/11 investigation. Secondly, when he talks about predictably becoming a victim, I call that victimology. So that's pretty much just political falderol that doesn't impress me much. Stephen has this baby face that and soft personality that seems to sell his positions, but the real meat of it is in Proposition 3. Attacking Stephen Jones. No, I'm not attacking Stephen Jones, but I am attacking his work because I find it so faulty and defective.
I think that's exactly right. It can be very subtle, sorting out, you know, ad hominem attacks against the person from serious criticism of the person's ideas. And I began this program with a case where he has claimed to have provided archaeological evidence in support of the proposition that Jesus Christ, after his resurrection, visited North America, which just happens to be a position that is defended by the Book of Mormon. And I explained how the kind of evidence he cites, which is some diagrams attributed to the Mayans, involves a kind of inkblot phenomenon where practically, you know, it's highly subjective as a matter of interpretation. And I explained how ordinarily a person's religion wouldn't enter into questions about their scientific research, but in this case he's claimed to have scientific evidence in support of his religious beliefs, which means it is a subject worthy of consideration. And that in courses I have taught in the past on science and pseudoscience, using a book about myths and frauds in archaeology, coincidentally, Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries, Science and Pseudoscience in Archaeology, fourth edition by Kenneth L. Fetter, we find exactly this kind of inkblot phenomenon going on in relation to the work of Eric von Däniken, who claimed, of course, that ancient astronauts had visited Earth and that the Earth was actually a colony populated by them. Von Däniken, of course, can't explain where those ancient astronauts came from, presumably visitations by even earlier ancient astronauts and then earlier ancient astronauts on and on. Unless somebody evolved somewhere, we can't have these ancient astronauts just popping up, which means he's got, in effect, a regressive explanation that defeats itself. But what I worry about here, Morgan, is as Judy and I have been discussing it, it looks as though Steve Jones' whole approach was conceived in sin, that he didn't do a suitable literature search, that he's now admitted that he knows of no case in which thermite has actually been used to bring down a building, and he's never actually established his proof of concept.
Well, I think that's where competition and cross-criticism done in a relatively civilized manner. Of course, there's going to be a few excesses on occasion, but that's it's cross-checking each other's work. It's peer review. And here's the way I would characterize it. If you look at this piece you've referenced earlier, the scientific method applied to the thermite hypothesis.
Yes.
What to put it crudely, I'd say that we've smoked out this admission by turning Stevens' preaching on the scientific method against his own preferred hypothesis. And in my opinion, a lot of what is going on here, for example, Stephen messes around with these dust samples that he claims came from this woman's apartment, or a piece of metal slag that came from allegedly came from the WTC site. Well, what about that? If you look at our article, let me quote before I go there. William Hazlitt, you may have encountered William Hazlitt in your studies, Jim, but he says in part, the origin of all science is in the desire to know causes. And that's where we raised this point about what of these samples, even if they were valid, have to do with what would a chemical analysis of a dust sample supposedly from the neighborhood of the WTC tell us? What's the logic? Where's the causation in terms of sorting out important hypotheses, discriminating amongst them? Just to have Stephen show us that he has pictures of a lab, you know, people in white smocks, doesn't impress me much. The question is, what are you looking at in terms of data, evidence, and what do you infer? What seems to have happened here? For example, I just object to the whole word collapse, even though I used to use it, because the Twin Towers were exploded into, ultrafine dust. Yes.
In your memorable phrase, blow
right.
The kingdom come.
Yeah, I didn't know how much I was saying at the time, but... that's what you, when you look at the video, the films, the DVD of the Twin Towers, that is a whole different thing than what happened in Building 7, which was a classic implosion.
That's absolutely right. Here you have the building's blowing up from the top down with the North and South Tower, as Judy has compared it to two gigantic trees turning to sawdust from the top
right.
down.
From
even
the top.
Steve admitted to me that when you see that 34 section of the South Tower start to collapse, all of a sudden, he admitted to me, it just turns to dust. It's just pulverized.
Right.
And he admitted that to me. And in fact,
like
during
that.
One of our an interview, a previous interview I had with him on an earlier talk show I had, where he came around and I pressed him when he used the word collapse, and I said, Steve, really, it's demolition, or it's pulverization, or
yeah,
it's destruction. You don't want to use the word collapse. And, of course, we have none of the phenomena that would be appropriate if it were a collapse, including a pile of pancakes, you know, floors that would be a sufficient mass to represent what would be the residue if the buildings had collapsed. It can't have taken place in the amount of time. There was no energy. There was no causation to initiate a collapse, no matter what NIST wants to palm mm-hmm. off on the public.
Yes, and of course, NIST never did model this pancake collapse.
They claimed to take it right up to the point of initiation, Morgan.
Yes, right, and they couldn't, and they cannot. Of course, Stephen hasn't done that either.
Of course, it would be so embarrassing to NIST because their model wouldn't at all correspond to the observable phenomenon, would thereby be falsified.
Right, so Wood Reynolds' article puts that all in the shade.
Stand by, we're talking with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays, Fridays, and occasionally subbing for me. Before I return to my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, I just want to make a couple of rather key points for the audience. Number one. This is not ganging up on Steve Jones. This is examining ideas and hypotheses he has advanced. That is the nature of science, and you don't want to confuse it with ad hominem attacks. Too many of his supporters have developed a cult-like attitude where any criticism of Stephen Jones' ideas is interpreted as criticism of him and unfair. Nothing could be more detrimental to the progress of science. Number two, I invited Stephen Jones to come on this program to defend his ideas. He declined. This is one of many opportunities, at least a half a dozen I have given him, to make public appearances to present and elaborate and defend his ideas that he has turned down. Number three, during the course of this program today, we have demonstrated that Stephen Jones' work is based upon an inadequate model of science. Number two, that it has no proof of concept. And number three, that it provides a hopelessly inadequate explanation of the phenomena that needs to be explained when you begin to appreciate their full dimensions. That has been the area in which Morgan Reynolds and Judy Wood have made, in my opinion, a monumental contribution by laying out for us in unmistakable detail and completeness the amount of destruction that took place at the World Trade Center. So I just want everyone to know that Stephen Jones has a standing invitation to come on this program at any time in the future he would like to do so to defend himself. And if he chooses to do that, I would particularly like him to address those three key points: the adequacy of his model of science, the absence of proof of concept, and why it appears to me that his explanation is hopelessly inadequate to account for the phenomena. Morgan, I'd like to invite you to comment on the situation as we find it, because it seems to me completely absurd that this website now that his followers have established, Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, should include attacks that imply that you and Judy are unscientific and that Steve is scientific, when the situation, when you analyze it adequately, appears to be a whole lot closer to the opposite.
Well, if we're so unscientific, they should be willing to have the hyperlinks as they do to their own pieces. So I find that disturbing that they won't give us equal time. And if they're going to be scholarly, you got to have the best advocates, the articles at hand are accessible, and let the sides try to compete. And even in the courts, of course, we profit by having an adversarial method where the attorneys on both sides go at it before a jury or a judge. So some rules of fair play include for scholars to allow the right references to be there. I find it interesting that on the page that you're citing, Jim Hoffman attacked me a year ago June. And he even, at the time, offered me reply space on his website. I haven't looked lately, but I would assume it's still there. Why didn't they have that?
That's an interesting case, Morgan, because Jim Hoffman also attacked me and scholars early on, and I published two replies, which I sent to him and asked him to put up on his website, but which he refused to do. Anyone who wants to see those, just scroll down into the article section on the left-hand side of st911.org. Go all the way to the bottom, and you'll find a little box with two articles replying to Jim Hoffman, which he refused to put up on his website. This one-sided approach, Morgan, is completely unacceptable. The fact they should have articles attacking you and Judy but not the links to your original paper is outrageous. And for them to, you know, claim that they have the moral or the scientific high ground is, in my opinion, frankly, indefensible and absurd.
I do not believe that Stephen Jones or any of his allies could confront Judy Wood and I in a debate and win. That's why they won't even come on your show. Stephen won't go on an appearance at the National Press Club. He refused your invitation to have a panel on conventional means of destroying the Twin Towers, or maybe even Tower 7. So why the no-show? Is it because we're so uncivilized and unscientific we're not worthy?
It's completely embarrassing, Morgan. I mean, in the history of science, the great scientists have stood up for their work. They have taken risks. They've taken chances. Galileo being a perfect example. Here's a man who ran the risk of execution to defend his ideas. And he had far more formidable forces opposed to him than Stephen Jones has ever confronted.
The one ground I would point out, Jim, just to distinguish your position from mine slightly here, is that, as Balfour said, science preceded the theory of science and is independent of it. So what Stephen Jones knows about the theory of science, to me, isn't very important. The important question is, what is his scientific work on 9/11? And kind of a third order question is, what was his preceding scientific record? I'm more concerned about his pro-establishment work to squash Pons and Fleischmann on cold fusion, the idea of cheap or virtually free energy. I'm suspicious about that because the MO has a certain superficial similarity to what's going on with 9/11, more so than what he says about finding evidence that Christ appeared in North America post-crucifixion.
Well, you're absolutely right, Morgan. I think as far as the science goes, but when all these claims are being made about Jones being scientific and you and Julie being unscientific, that raises issues that are philosophical. What is the nature of science? And it's very clear to me, having, you know, spent my professional career dealing with these issues, that his conception of scientific method is indefensible. It focuses on single hypothesis. When you have to look at families of hypotheses, you have to be considering the full range, and it's part and parcel of why I think that, you know, he is creating a primrose path for those who are naive about the nature of science to follow him, but it's a path that, in my judgment, is leading nowhere. It seems to exemplify what Lakatos calls a degenerating research program. It's not spawning new hypotheses. It's not spawning new articles and publications, new research, new experiments. And I'm troubled by the whole charade that what he is doing is the real science and what the rest of us are doing is non-science.
Right. And as you said, Judy said, after more than a year, where's the fruit? Where's it going? It seems to be leading us into a cul-de-sac, a dead end. And what really concerned me this past summer when I and Judy started to evaluate Stephen's work in print is if the movement was, the 9/11 movement was putting all of its eggs in the Stephen Jones basket, we were headed for a fall.
I think that's absolutely right, Morgan, and that's part and parcel why when I became convinced, especially after reviewing the data that you and Judy had amassed about the extent of the devastation, it became obvious to me that thermite couldn't possibly explain it all, that I felt it was indispensable to broaden the full range of alternative hypotheses under consideration, and that if we remained exclusively fixated on thermite, we were leading ourselves into a kind of intellectual disaster. So I agree completely. And, of course, it's at exactly this point in time when all of these unrelenting assaults began to emerge from the other side, those who are the friends and allies and supporters of Stephen Jones, most of which were based upon alleged claims that his work was scientific and ours or yours or Judy's was unscientific. And I'm here to say categorically that that's false. That's propaganda. That is misleading information. And it appears to be advanced for the sake of a political agenda.
Well, to take a specific example, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Stephen was the one who coined the term space beam when we speculated about the high likelihood, I think, that the towers were brought down by a directed energy weapon of some kind or other. It could have been from a satellite, but we don't contend that. We don't know. But the point is to just scoff and dismiss.
That's right.
Scientific hypothesis does not speak well of that scientist.
That's right. That's a perfect example of a straw man in a single phrase. Morgan Reynolds, I want to thank you for coming on my show. I have a standing invitation to Stephen Jones to appear on the Dynamic Duo with Jim Fetzer. Thank you all for listening.
Hello, hello.